All right. Welcome, everyone. I'll go around and say hi, starting with Marv. I always feel bad because you're in the middle of something. I make you stop. Peter. Sam. Shane. Shoketsu. Jinryu. Tyler, Paul, Bob, Franklin, Karen, Susan, Mick, Jill, Gathel, Joan, John, Katie, and Ruth Ann. And Linda. Okay, cool. Trying to think if there are any announcements. Term student program begins March 6th. Information in the newsletter and on the website. That's a 3-month program where So you commit to the opening and closing retreats and keeping a set of personal vows in the middle, in the meantime. And and ideally you come to another retreat or two in the middle or something, but it's individually variable. And it's a way to get to know people better and to also kind of have some more cohort support for your intentions for a few months. So consider joining us in that. And I think, is it 2 weeks? Nehan ceremony is coming up pretty soon. It's not this Sunday. It might be the following Sunday. I think so. That will, take the place of our usual chanting service. And that is a ceremony that commemorates the Buddha's passing. And it's of special significance in Buddhism because it's not only like a memorial and a kind of a thanks for the founder of Buddhism, the teachings, but it also acknowledges that that it's okay that the Buddha died. Like unlike so many religions, it's not dependent on him, on the person, on anything particularly remarkable about him. He left us the teachings and the practice, and that is the essence of Buddhism. So ironically, it's like, well, you know, it was great that he was able to die and just leave the Dharma to us. And it's a very sweet ceremony, which we will not have done on Zoom before, but, you know, that's what we're having to figure out is how we do all this on Zoom. Yeah. Anything else anybody can think of? Or do you have any questions about stuff that's happening or coming up? Okay. So tonight.
I have a question, Domio.
Yeah.
I know we're finishing The World Could Be Otherwise tonight, and you said then we're going to start the fundamental teachings and based off of your podcast. Are you going to like list which podcasts or?
Yes, it's on the website. So if you go under. Like our weekly weekly events and Tuesday study. Uh-huh. Like there's the Tuesday study page on the website has all the breakdown of the topic.
Oh, it does? Oh, okay.
And the podcast link too. And so probably in this week's newsletter, Lisa will include, the first few of those at least. And there'll be a link in that thing in the newsletter, you know, to go to see more on the Tuesday study page.
Okay,
perfect. So it's all laid out and planned, and you can see which podcast episodes they link to. And more recent podcasts, I don't really have a full written out script. It's more of just an outline. But those ones from back then, it's all fully written out as well. So if you prefer to read it rather than listen to it, that's available.
Okay, thank you.
There we go. Thank you, Rick. Yeah, so we're wrapping up. The world could be otherwise. Imagination and the Bodhisattva path. And we're on chapter 7, the second half, on the perfection of understanding. So the other perfections, just to review, are generosity, ethical behavior, patience, joyful effort, meditation, and then understanding. Sometimes it's called wisdom, but I really like how Fisher suggests it, understanding, because wisdom suggests kind of a, I don't know, you have to be old, you have to be wise or something, but understanding, and understanding also has an aspect of like being kind of accepting and compassionate as well when you're understanding. So I would say that the other paramitas are essential, but it's the perfection of understanding. This is the part of Buddhist practice that leads to liberation and freedom. This is you can't really say the crucial part, because it's all the parts are important. But I like to think this is what's uniquely Buddhist. This is the, you know, because when the Buddha awakened to something profound and created this path of practice for us that has lasted millennia, what did he awaken to? The other parts, right? There's no rocket science about you should be generous and ethical and patient. I mean, those kinds of ideals of human behavior, you know, are found in any religious or spiritual practice. They're you know, you try your best to be patient and hardworking and whatever. But this perfection of understanding is different. This is what leads us to our liberation and freedom. So we could be doing our very best to be generous and ethical and patient and do joyful effort and practice our meditation, but we could still be trapped. We could still be just striving and trying to remake this flawed being into something just a smidge better before the end of our lives, as opposed to awakening to a completely different relationship with life. So the perfection of understanding. Understanding what? Now, all understanding is good. There's all kinds of understanding. But the pivotal, the perfection of understanding, it's difficult to wrap your mind around it. I like how Fisher portrays that in this chapter. He's like, you can't really, I don't know if you noticed, but he had practices at the end of each chapter that you could do to cultivate this. And then this one, he's just like, yeah, you can't really cultivate it. You can cultivate the other things, right? You practice all the other paramitas with an eye toward cultivating understanding. So what we're trying to understand is reality, the way really things really are. And the crux of the matter is, reality is not as we assume it to be. We assume it to be a particular way, which ends up being really problematic, and we're wrong. So this is the key point. So one way of describing that reality that we are trying to awaken to understand, to see, to let go of our delusions so we can see the way things really are, which we talked about last week, and we've talked about in previous chapters, but is translated as emptiness. Shunyata is the word. Sometimes it can be translated as boundlessness, emptiness, interbeing. He talked about earlier in the chapter how this is related to a word that means it's kind of like a balloon, kind of an illusion. It's empty inside. And what is it empty of? It's empty of svabhava, or own being. So this assumption that we make that we, especially us, we assume everything has own being, but it's kind of natural, right? We're particularly concerned with our own being. That's our central central issue. So in one of my favorite books, Why Buddhism is True, evolutionary psychologist Robert Wright talks about essentialism and how humans are just, we're just wired to project essentialism. Like everything has an essence. And the example that I love, he says, okay, so you have a tape measure and, you know, it's just this ordinary item, but somebody told you this tape measure, this was John F. Kennedy's tape measure that he used quite a lot. And like, now we think of this, like that is, now it's different, right? That tape measure is different now because it belonged to JFK. I mean, physically, it's not different than it was the moment before, but now it has a different, and of course that is all, that significance is all constructed by our own mind. Not that it doesn't have some relevance in our culture, right? But it's, we're constructing that significance. And so essentially that is what we're doing with ourselves and with everything. It's like, we're just, there's some essence in there. So one of the, an analogy that came up for me recently in terms of trying for myself to maintain more of a perspective of like the perfection of understanding as I go about my day is, I guess, to imagine myself as an actor in a play or a movie. Peter, imagine myself as an actor in a play or a movie. And, you know, the part that I'm playing, you know, this person gets assaulted or unfairly fired or, you know, gets a disease or, you know, some terrible thing happens, you know, to the character that I'm playing. But as the actor, I get really upset. Or if you imagine you're in a play and like somebody else gets really upset, like, oh man, what are you doing? That's totally unfair. You'd be like, this is what? This is just part of the plot. So I've been saying that to myself lately, you know, when something arises that brings up that sense of self, it's like, it's just part of the plot. As opposed to the sense of like, I've got an investment on how this turns out and this wasn't fair. And so it's like a whole self-centered way of interpreting what's going on. So Fisher talks about this on page 186. He says, he's talking about emptiness, self-reflection, and humor. He said, I want to return for a moment to the story of Bodhidharma and the emperor. So Bodhidharma comes from India. The Chinese emperor is excited that this Zen master came, and he says, let's see what he says. You know, what is the merit that I've gained from doing all the Buddhist work that I've done? And Bodhidharma says, no merit. And then he says, well, who are you? And Bodhidharma says, I don't know. And then he goes off and meditates in a cave for 9 years. So it says, note how swiftly their exchange moves from emptiness, which sounds so philosophical, to 9 years of solitary meditation. So Bodhidharma basically says, all of what you've done is empty. To really appreciate what emptiness means, you have to look deeply within. You have to investigate the self. Bodhidharma's response to the question, who are you? I don't know, is important. The perfection of understanding is not about something out there we are analyzing or thinking through. It's about us, our lives, our intentions and feelings, our identities. Who are you? Who am I? This is where the perfection of understanding flashes forth. So I'm always struck by as people, for instance, in Zen Sesshin, and we're sitting meditating deeply and trying to awaken to this perfection of understanding. What is meant by this? What is it? You know, what is the nature of this self? And it's so natural for us to, you know, either we're focused on our kind of troubling self-concern, or when we start to think about the emptiness of self, we're contemplating like it's going to be some kind of transcendent thing we awaken to out there, some kind of insight we get about the universe. But the insight ends up being like, you know, right here, us, like extremely personal. So when we realize that we are empty of this essence, there is only things as it is, as Shinryu Suzuki likes to say. Things as it is, which I love, you know, it captures the multiplicity of things, but also the wholeness of things. And we have our preferences. It's natural to prefer pleasure over pain, success over failure, intimacy over loneliness, all that stuff. But there's a way it can all just feel like this is just part of the plot, you know? I don't like how things are going right now. Okay. You know, that's, and not be like all overwrought. And it can actually feel quite, I'm fond of making the comparison, if you knew you were only going to live one more week or one more day, no matter what happened over the next 24 hours, you would be grateful just to be alive. You'd be like, wow, look at that. The light turned red. Wow, look at that. I dropped an egg on the floor and it splattered all over. Huh. I mean, you just, the whole perspective would be so different that actually life, everything that happens would be precious. So I wanted to explore together, and I don't know if this is going to be just too obscure, but I wanted to explore in breakouts, what are the implications of emptiness? How does this teaching or personal realization, to whatever extent we may have had it, whatever, to whatever intuition we may have, that the things are not as they appear, that the self is not as solid and inherently real as we assume, how does this relate to our lives? If you come to understand there is no fixed essential you, how does that change how you think of your relationships or how you meet daily irritations, like I was talking about, or challenges? How do you respond to criticism? There's no essential you. How do you respond to success or failure? How do you face illness or death? There really is a sense that there is no essential you. So I'm thinking of examples of how understanding emptiness, particularly the emptiness of ourself, changes how we respond to life. So if you have some experience of intuition, of just momentary glimpse, maybe in your life, just a hint. I like to think it's not a black and white thing of just either you have a sticky, big sense of self, or, you know, you're over here and you're a saint and you've awakened completely and you have not troubled with a sense of self anymore. It's not that dualistic. I like to think that we can awaken to sense, we can develop a sense of less self, where the self feels a little lighter or more fluid. Perhaps there's moments that are like that. So it's really more of a spectrum between that, so having a really wrought, solid, tortured sense of self and no sense of self, somewhere in between. So if you have some experience of that, how does that affect, how has that affected your behavior or choices at certain times? What's some examples? And if you can't really relate to this, if you're thinking, I don't know what the heck emptiness of self is, then think about it a little bit more in terms of this imaginative bodhisattva that we've been studying in this book. You know, that Fisher says we have this bodhisattva ideal is for our imagination. So we're imagining, what would it be like if you had that much more fluid, open sense of self? How would you behave differently in your daily life? So but please feel free to just ask questions clarifying what kind of the discussion is about. So I'm thinking of like a list of examples of behaviors, responses, ways of engagement. Questions? All right then. I will put you into breakout rooms.
That depending on how long you've practiced it or where you've been or what your activities have been can be pretty jarring. Like after a session.
Mm. Yeah, there's just a sense of permeability.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's almost like if I really got this, every day would be like at a session.
I think it changes like what you view as like sort of like necessities in life, I guess. Mm-hmm. It changes, you know, when you have these I don't think I've ever reached this, but my example is after sort of like what Jinri just said, but after I was lucky to go on like a 30-day long canoe trip with the same 10 people down this long river. We didn't see anyone else, and it was just paddling, very meditative, quiet sort of thing. And then all of a sudden we were thrust back into the city. Mm-hmm. With no sort of preparedness for that. And then how it just totally changed what you view as necessary. And I feel, you know, what you need in life to be happy. And I feel like that would be sort of a similar sort of thing if you have these moments of emptiness of self, you would rethink what you necessities you need to be happy.
Yeah, I think actually Norman Fisher mentioned in his practice on or chapter on patience that like what makes suffering painful is the ownership of suffering, right? Mm-hmm. So like when you think about it with an understanding of emptiness, that suffering doesn't belong to you. It belongs to everyone and everything. And so I think that it like can help with sort of like patience and like in that sense that like this isn't mine, this isn't particularly, you know, something that I'm dealing with, this is something that is, it just is, you know.
I think it allows me to respond in a less serious way about things. So with more humility and humor around my actions and thoughts.
Mm. Someone in our group mentioned that they'd be less concerned about outcomes. Mm. And life would be much more peaceful.
I find that I'm more open to learning things, to everything that's out there that's is more interesting to me and it's more fascinating. The less self-centered I am, if you will. And I found that has been a process. As I age, I'm just more interested in the world. Rather than withdrawing from it, I'm more interested.
Like that.
So I was thinking about how it's, I heard that it's better to not tell children that they're smart or they're pretty or they're a natural athlete, because it actually makes them try less hard. They think that it kind of puts them in a box. And so it's better to praise like behaviors or things like, I saw that you worked really hard on that art piece. Mm-hmm. Not you're such an artist, because it kind of reinforces that essentialism, you know, that they are a certain thing. And that was before I knew much about Buddhism.
Yeah. You want to say something, Ruthann?
Oh, yes. I think if the Dalai Lama, or if Thich Nhat Hanh, when he still had speech, were asked a question, I think they would simply be more present than most of us are, not so worried about how they're going to come across, as someone said earlier, the outcome, but just be fully present, which is another way of saying boundlessness. Thank you.
And of course, that's related to something somebody else said in our group, which is a less stage fright, less that kind of fear and self-consciousness. Awakened bodhisattva probably wouldn't experience.
I asked our group if there's any parallels between being retired and then how you viewed the being enthralled at work when you were at a working age, and just being able to relinquish all the ties and effort that you put in during those years, and looking back at it from a retirement view must look a lot different. So I asked the group about that.
Yeah, the way the Buddha put it was, we're engaged in a whole lot of I, me, and mine making. We're constantly like, that's mine, that's me, that's, you know, and that's where the suffering comes from.
Just as Shane said that, because I remember him bringing it up in our group, and as he said it the second time, that's when it really clicked for me about how different it really looks from where I sit right now. It does not look, I mean, I was having a good time. I enjoyed my work, and thank God I got paid for it. But looking back, that it was ugly. It was pretty ugly. Mm. Very self-centered, very focused on the outcome. And how bad it was if the outcome that you achieved was not the one that was expected.
Yeah, and I mean, that's tough when you have to stay engaged and you have to try to do your best, and maybe even you have to compete. And then, like that, how to do that without getting all wrapped up in I, me, and mind making. It's like, oh, you have to learn a whole new way of relating and being.
Yeah.
It occurred to me that when we have less of a sense of self, less likely to be caught in blame, self-blame, sensitive to criticism. You know, when you have a sense of like essential self, and you tell me that I just did something terrible or made a big mistake or whatever, you criticize me, like that threatens my whole sense of myself, right? I thought I was an okay person. You're telling me I'm not. So either I have to get defensive or maybe you're right and I suck. So, I mean, I used to be really, really sensitive to criticism. I wouldn't pretend like I was sensitive to criticism. I would like blow you off, but then I was really upset. And I don't know, just, you know, at some point in practice, it just kind of shifted to like, well, that's good information. Thank you for letting me know. I mean, nobody's perfect. I'm not perfect. I'm a work in progress. Like if there's less of that sense of like, I mean, on the one hand, that essential sense of self, sometimes it's puffed up. And that feels good, right? But then that sense, same sense of self can be crushed. And that feels terrible. So opting out of both is a much more stable way to be.
I think in a related area, I've been thinking about resilience. I think you know, deeper understanding would make you more resilient, make me more resilient. And I think about things like COVID and how some people are really push against, you know, ideas like masks and stuff like that. And I think I'm sure there's a relationship there and I haven't quite figured it out, but I find myself a lot more resilient than I used to be about a lot of things. So.
In Franklin, in a flexible way, or what's another
word to go along? Yeah, like I don't take it. I think it's related to what Domio's saying. I don't take stuff as personally as I used to. I don't think that everything is necessarily about me. So that's like just incrementally getting a little better that way. Whereas I think I can see it in some of my friends. They take things more to heart and not in a good way. Resilience is good. Thank you.
I had something that Mick kind of made me think about as well, is that I think that how we understand other people's suffering is different too when we have an understanding of emptiness. Particularly I think of like with kids, you often see a pretty constant attempt to stop them from being unhappy. So if they're crying in the grocery, you know, if you're crying where you're trying to do things to stop them from feeling that way and make them better and hear the things to make you better. And perhaps again, I don't think I've reached a lot of stages of feeling emptiness, but I think, yeah, it works with how we understand other people's suffering and how we support or be with other people in their suffering.
Yeah. I know for me, there's, you know, when we respond to other people's suffering, you know, a lot of it is like, if you really look in there, there's a lot of self-interest in there. You know, stop crying in the grocery store because you're embarrassing me and I don't want to deal with it. Or like, you know, you're my spouse, don't be depressed because I don't want, you know, like, I don't want to deal with it. Or if I was a good friend or a good spouse or something, then you wouldn't be feeling that way. Or this reflects on, can I make you feel better? I'm identified with being able to make you feel better. So like, if we look in there, a lot of times there is a lot of sense of self involved in that effort, not just really sincerely hoping, because a lot of times there's nothing we can do at the moment, right? And just being present and listening, whatever, is often the best thing.
This is making me think of a meeting that I attended around 1991, where I was a very low-level doctor, and it was a grand rounds, and the chief resident asked another a lower level surgical resident, but again, I was a medical student, so I was below all residents, but asked this resident some questions that I thought were so tough that I just, out of my emptiness, I propose, I laughed. And the chief resident turned to me and said, "Why don't you answer these questions? Do you think they're so easy?" And, you know, I think the impact of my having this emptiness was that I was just free to be sympathetic for this resident, and my laughter was misunderstood. Oh, well. I felt a bit badly, but so be it.
Sometimes that's where I mean, I think we've all had this kind of experience, right, of kind of getting out of our way for some reason, you know, either we're kind of like taken by surprise or we just kind of act in this spontaneous way. And actually what comes out is strangely appropriate, maybe better than we could have thought, you know, planned. So I'm curious to know, you know, one of the things that Fisher says is the outcome of this perfection of understanding is a sense of humor. So on page 188, he says, in the generosity chapter, we discussed at length the importance of attitude. To a large extent, bodhisattva practice is a matter of attitude, and humor and irony are essential ingredients in the bodhisattva attitude. If we are going to take in the entire mass of human suffering with loving concern, we better see the humor in it so we can hold it lightly. Like comedians who joke about serious things without denying their seriousness, bodhisattvas must have the capacity to hold suffering and humor in balance. Taking things too seriously is a sure sign you have lost the thread of the emptiness teachings. We could call the perfection of understanding the perfection of irony. Well, what do people think about that? I mean, when we're facing all this crap in the world, like, what does it mean for a bodhisattva to have a sense of humor or irony about it?
Well, I think in some ways, if you're able to, I think you just use the term step out of your own way, or, you know, not be so concerned about what people think of you or what you look like, or, you know, if you're wearing the right clothes, or just have, you know, be rid of that self-concern of what people think of you. You're able to present yourself in a more authentic way. And I don't know, just you're able to, maybe laugh at yourself or laugh at a situation that is just impossible to deal with. And I think it's comforting to other people when you are more sincere and authentically yourself. It gives them the space to also be authentic back, and that's kind of stress relieving. You're able to show another person, hey, I'm gonna let my ego to the side and just authentically be who I am, and I'd like to also know who you are, you know, trying to open up that door for a genuine relationship. And that somehow does seem to help difficult situations, I think.
You're making me think of how, I don't remember seeing this for quite a while, but I remember as a kid, I really noticed whenever an adult tripped and fell, and I just was so remarkable how, like, that could be an incredibly awkward moment or not a big deal depending on what the person did, right? Which so often adults were just like, that didn't happen, you know, and it's just like this awkward, but if somebody just said, you know, just, oh, look at that, I just made a mistake, I just tripped and fell, then it was, you know, a moment of humor and it wasn't a big deal. I don't know, this popped into my mind when you said that.
You know, a lot of times people do a lot of laughing at memorial services. I mean, not mm. in the service, but afterwards when everybody gets together, because people are being very real. Their emotions are heightened and they see people they don't see that often. And there's a little bit of joy mixed in there, even with the sorrow. And I think of Bodhisattva, I mean, using your imagination, they're able to kind of hold all these things at the same time. And that's kind of what you're doing at a memorial service. Oftentimes you're holding the feeling that you have for that person that has died and their family that are grieving so hard. But also, you know, some joy about the fact that they lived, you know, and your appreciation for them. Mm. So, yeah, I just think that that's kind of what he's getting at a little bit. I'm not so sure about the irony. you don't see people being ironic at memorial services so much. But there's a lot of laughter. Yeah.
In the moment, sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm done. Go ahead.
In the moment of being, finding humor, it's an acceptance of our humanity. I mean, the Greeks knew that, tragedy and comedy. In tragedy, we're not fully denying our humanness. So there is that capacity for joy. And Buddhism accepts that because that's part of the full connection we have with life. And there are languages that have everyday phrases that people know, like, no matter what happens in this moment, I'm alive. You know, maybe I don't know who else of my loved ones survived, but in this moment. And English does not have that concept in our language, because we don't have that concept in our more common everyday possibility.
Yeah, I confess I'm not the greatest at not taking things too seriously. I mean, you know, when I think about my climate activism work, I think that pretty seriously. Like, life or death matter, you know. I mean, we have a sense of humor about racial injustice and, you know, people attacking our capital, and like, so it's not, I get a sense that it's not a direct intellectual thing, right? It's having a sense of, you know, the gravity and the truth. But I don't know, I guess it's that larger perspective that allows another way that I've heard it put is the Bodhisattva puts aside grief for the world, which I think is very interesting. So the Bodhisattva is definitely not putting aside, I mean, the Bodhisattva's vowed to save all beings, you know, every last one, come back lifetime after lifetime until everyone is saved. So they're on point, right? They care, but they're putting aside the grief. And I think that's it's one of the reasons that I personally kind of resisted embracing the emptiness teachings completely for a while, because I was afraid they would make me not care. I was afraid, and I didn't want to stop caring. I didn't want to stop being, you know, passionately motivated to help. And then one day I understood the emptiness teachings, and we awakened to them a little bit at a time, and I began to realize how, you know, setting aside our own pain makes us only the more available. So if I'm all overwrought in pain and distress, I mean, that's not that helpful. But if I'm coming from a place of calmness and perspective, I'm more helpful.
I think another way to think about this is, oh, was with somebody else talking? Did I step on somebody?
Franklin and then Choketsu.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. humor and irony is almost like a coping mechanism for the fact that these perfections are ultimately unattainable.
Mm.
At least in this lifetime, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise you go kind of crazy. So that's, I don't know. I think that's kind of it. I mean, I think it's just human nature to use these as mechanisms to help us cope.
Because it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, I write these, you know, Dharma talks about bodhisattva ideals and emptiness and whatever. And if my pocket gets caught in the kitchen drawer, I go, shit. I mean, what the hell is that? What? How did that even... Human beings are ridiculous. Shoketsu?
I was just going to say that I've... Through the last months or a few months, I've been drawn to going to YouTube and watching commentary by the late night comics on the very serious stuff that's going on around us, and they're able to make us laugh about it, you know, the absurdity. In fact, I learn things from them. So I find that a real important release for me.
Yeah, and if somebody can make you laugh really, really hard about something that's like really, really serious,
mm-hmm.
it's extremely cathartic. it's very healing. It's like, oh my God, I needed that. All right, well, it is 9:00. Say a little closing verse. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Domio.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for being here.
Sweet dreams.
You too.